Live from New York City, it's the Gary Null Show. And now, your host, Gary Null.
Hi, everyone. I'm Gary Null, and I'd like to welcome you to this program, broadcasting live and video streaming live from our studios in New York City. Today, an in-depth look at how all of those individuals in America who are having problems with diabetes or pre-diabetic conditions, that's about 90 million Americans, what can you do to stabilize your blood sugar? I'll give you a list of foods that safely reduce blood glucose from Michael Downey of Life Extension. I'm going to take a nutrient that most people don't use. The vast majority of Americans never heard of it. It's called carnitine. Carn, C-A-R-N, itine, I-T-I-N-E. Very important. It can really rejuvenate cellular function. So for everyone over the age of 40, you should pay attention to what it can do. I'll share the latest from Logan Bromwell on that. Today, probiotics, how they help the body, how they help the brain. I'm also going to talk about what happens when we just can't get over a problem, when we stress about it, what actually goes on in the body that can harm us. Doubling down on stress, think twice, and then extended periods of time today for some commentaries. I'm very concerned that people in America are clueless about what could possibly happen to them if they're in a major city, a major metropolitan area. Yes, Hurricane Sandy devastated people near the beaches and in the lower areas of Manhattan and on the Jersey Shore and Long Island. But for the vast majority of people, they saw what it did, but they're out of harm's way. Think again. Today, a very comprehensive understanding of what happens when you think you're not in a problem area, but you really are. I'm only going to select one city today, Phoenix. So for all of you who are listening from Phoenix or the immediate area, it's all about the problems that you're going to be facing out there. Lots of them. An in-depth discussion from our public health and environmental segment by William DeBise from Tom's Dispatch. And then, time permitting, I want to do a commentary, my own as well as a commentary from Chris Hedges, Truth Dig, Kill Anything That Moves. I've had the opportunity to interview more than 1,000 veterans of the Gulf conflicts from 1991 till today. I have interviewed hundreds upon hundreds in their encampments around the United States. I want to share my insights. I want to share Chris's insights about why we have so many people today who are suffering from post-traumatic stress disorder, what the government's not telling you, the over-glorification of combat, the never questioning what we do to obtain an end. Any means is justified. The Bill O'Reilly, the Sean Hannity, the Fox Network, talking heads that proselytize for America first. Let's begin. We should be consuming probiotics every day. The math is simple. We have 10 to 100 times more bacteria in our body than we have cells. And it's estimated that we have anywhere from 70 to 100 trillion cells. Now, that bacteria communicates. There's an intricate network, and it's all based upon the notion of epigenetics. Epa, meaning the larger environment that you're in, and genetics, the individual genes. And we really owe all of this understanding to Bruce Lipton, the biologist, molecular biologist who first found that when he removed the DNA from some cells, they still functioned for a period of time. And that would be like removing an engine from a car and it still drives. Well, how's that possible? It took him years to understand. But now we understand that that the environment that you're in, the people that you're around, the thoughts you have, the music you listen to, the color schemes, the ability to be open, honest, flowing with energy, the exchange of positive energy and surrendering negative, all that determines the health of a given cell. Therefore, the more positive reinforcement we have, the healthier we're going to be and the greater our likelihood of recovering from serious illnesses. That's also true in children. When you keep children in cities, no matter how fancy the apartment, no matter how much time and attention you give them, you're depriving them of that necessary connection with nature, with trees and flowers and running in fields and playing and looking at animals. All that is also a part. So when it comes down to that bacteria, the better bacteria you have, the healthier the bacteria you have, the healthier you're going to be. There are at least 1,000 studies in the peer-reviewed literature showing the power of good bacteria, what we call probiotics. So every time you have probiotics, you're doing something good for your cells. Here's the latest. University of Michigan Health System, published in the peer-reviewed journal Gastroenterology, it says, for those with irritable bowel syndrome who wonder if stress aggravates their intestinal disorder, a new study shows that it's not all in your head. Researchers reveal that while stress does not cause irritable bowel syndrome, it does alter brain-gut interactions and induces the intestinal inflammation that often leads to severe chronic belly pain, loss of appetite, and diarrhea. Stress has a way of suppressing an important component called an inflammasome, which is needed to maintain normal gut microbiota. But probiotics reverse the effects of this animal, meaning if you have good probiotics, you can actually inhibit the inflammation in your gut. That's good news. All of us are faced with crisis and problems that we're not always able to solve. All right, what do we do? Well, if we're wise, if we put our best efforts out and things don't change the way we want or hope or need, there comes a time when you just have to surrender the effort. You have to go on with your life and accept that not everything is going to come out the way you want it. But then we have to deal with our conditioned self that wants to double down, find salvation through redemption. I'll show them, and then through this, I'll get my reputation back, or I'll get their trust back, or I'll be back on top. I'll get back what I lost. You pay a heavy price for that effort. It's always best just to start from scratch. Open a new page in your life. That's all. Here's some of the problems if you don't. From Medical News Today, this was from the annual meeting at Ohio State University of the American Psychosomatic Society. Quote, ruminating, that means thinking over and over again about stressful events, may increase inflammation in the body. In fact, it increases C-reactive protein, and we know that C-reactive protein is a marker of tissue inflammation, especially of your heart. And therefore, if you have an elevated C-reactive protein, you're actually more likely to have a heart attack or a stroke. Quote, studies have demonstrated associations between certain mental states or behaviors and C-reactive protein levels. Scientists from Duke University's Medical Center found that healthy people who are prone to mild to moderate depression symptoms, anger, or hostility tend to produce higher C-reactive protein. So what it means is this. If you walk around and you can't let stuff go, you just can't get beyond it, you hold on to grudges, you're envious, you're angry about everything, you are actually creating inflammation, including C-reactive protein, and that can kill you. That can cause a heart attack or a stroke. So just remember, let it go. Walk on. Turn another page. One more good study just out, again published in the peer-reviewed journal of Gastroenterology, quote, daily supplements of probiotic strains can affect parts of the brain linked to emotion and sensation. And quote, this is a big step forward, they say in the article. So another good reason that we should be eating foods like sauerkraut, which is good, and non-dairy, let's say yogurt that has like rice yogurt, soy yogurt that has probiotics. Or if, I know many of you in your compounded green products, powders, and your red product powders, your fruit powders, you're getting a ton, billions of probiotics. But for the average person who's not, healthier brain when you resupply healthy bacteria to your gut. This is from the Mayo Clinic. They're concerned. I'm happy about this. Quote, more parents say they won't vaccinate daughters against human papillomavirus. Parents increasingly concerned about potential side effects. I'll quote this from their clinic. A rising percentage of parents say they won't have their teen daughters vaccinated to protect against the human papillomavirus, even though physicians are increasingly recommending adolescent vaccination. This is a study from the Mayo Clinic. More than 2 in 5 parents surveyed believe the human papillomavirus vaccine is unnecessary, and a growing number worry about potential side effects. The published article was in Pediatrics. Okay, here's what I'm going to do. I'm challenging the Mayo Clinic today. I'm challenging the journal Pediatrics. This Friday, I will bring one of America's leading academic board-certified pediatricians on the program for the entire program. I will also bring on research that will prove beyond a shadow of a doubt that they have been lying to you about the human papillomavirus, what it will do, who should get it, and its side effects. The parents are right. No one should be getting this virus vaccine. It's a fraud. I'm calling out the manufacturer. I'm calling you a fraud. I'm calling out the state legislators. You're just idiots. Because you sit down with ALEC, the American Legislative Exchange Council, which are corporations, including pharmaceutical companies, who write bills to protect their profits, and you pass them trying to mandate the vaccine schedule. I'm calling out the, well, you can't call out the people of the FDA. You're assuming they have a brain to understand what you're saying. But they're controlled completely by the special interest groups, the pharmaceutical interests. We are going to completely deconstruct the so-called science and the so-called expert opinions for an entire hour. I'm flying in Friday on my dime, America's leading expert on the human papillomavirus, Gardasil, and hopefully the people in this audience will spread the message that this is going to happen, so we'll have people listening in. Anyone, knowing anyone in a vaccine advocacy group, should pay attention. This will be an exclusive. It's time that we took on the vaccine industries, the regulatory industries, the subsequent media, the scientists for hire, the pediatricians who refuse to do their homework. That's this Friday. And finally, unhealthy eating can make a bad mood worse. This is from Penn State University. I'll quote, taking part in unhealthy eating behaviors may cause women who are concerned about their diet and self-image to experience a worsening of their moods. In a study, college-age women who were concerned about their eating behaviors reported that moods worsened after bouts of disordered eating. There was little in the way of mood changes right before the unhealthy eating behaviors. However, negative mood was significantly higher after these behaviors. Now, of course, they didn't know why. I wrote two books on this called The Food-Mood Connection, and I've done reports on this, and I've done clinical studies on this. The chemicals in much of the food that people eat, especially their comfort food, high in refined carbohydrates and animal proteins and simple sugars, these directly impact brain chemistry and hence can imbalance dopamine and serotonin levels. They can also cause cerebral allergies. So, they are now acknowledging a food mood connection, but there have been many people who have understood how it all works. Back in a moment, please stay with us. Welcome all of you. I'm Gary Nolan, broadcasting live from our studios in New York City. I shared with you that I will do a little bit more in-depth, much like a classroom on the air, each day this week with something about our health. Today I'm going to focus upon carnitine and also how to maintain your blood sugar, two different issues. First, we know this, that the older you get, older after the age of 37, the more susceptible your heart is to fluctuations in blood glucose. Therefore, you have to pay extra attention to maintaining normal blood sugar levels. And a lot of people, because of nutrient deficiencies, the drugs they're taking, they end up with insulin malfunction. And we want to create insulin sensitivity, which facilitates the more efficient removal of glucose from the blood. Most people, however, are unaware that foods are known to decrease blood sugar levels. And let me just give you a couple examples. Two of the best. I'd put them high up on my list if I were diabetic or pre-diabetic or overweight. Black beans, soybeans, and barley, unhulled barley. They are extremely good for maintaining glycemic control. In effect, they help to lower blood sugar and inhibit diabetes and other glycemic stress-related problems like heart disease and obesity. So when you are able to have these in your diet on a regular basis, and there's lots of ways. For example, with black beans, you can get, if you don't want to cook them, which is less expensive and easier, you can get a can of black beans, organic black beans. And again, you rinse them out of the can, and then you can put them in a blender with your favorite seasonings. I like to use lemon juice, about 2 teaspoons of lemon juice. I like to use some shredded or grated horseradish and ginger, some mustard, and then whip that into blend. It takes 20 seconds to make this, and you blend that, and you end up with a pate. You can then stuff that into avocado, celery. You can take some rice chips and eat it. That's a tasty way to help kill bacteria and viruses, to help kill cancer cells, to help lower blood sugar, blood pressure, and cholesterol. All that with something as simple as some black beans with the condiments I mentioned. Or you could make a black bean soup. Or you could make some black beans and maybe saute some shallots, shiitake mushrooms, with your favorite seasonings like cardamom, anise, fennel, and then have that with some brown rice. So there's no limit to what you can do. Barley, on the other hand, you could have as a barley soup in the morning, or barley cereal in the morning. You could have your barley and put some raspberries or blueberries or cherries on. Cinnamon, the more cinnamon, up to about a quarter teaspoon, the better it is, because the cinnamon's one of the highest ORAC contributing spices in all of nature. Quite simply, the more cinnamon you use in a week, the healthier you're going to be. It can help prevent a lot of disease because it protects your cells. It also adds flavor. And then you mix all this into your barley. You can use, if you want a little sweeter, you could use the Manuka honey, and put in some protein powder, and you get a great breakfast. Or barley mushroom soup. So there's lots of ways of doing it. Well, there's a new study from the National Institutes of Health that shows that 35% of Americans age 20 or older have really bad blood sugar levels. They're pre-diabetic. Now, that's almost 100 million Americans between pre-diabetic and diabetic. That's an awful lot of people. Barley is also very good in soluble fiber. Now, there's two types. There's insoluble dietary fiber, which is found in whole grains, including barley, and that reduces your blood sugar level. And overweight women in particular were shown to lower their insulin and glucose responses following a barley soup. So have barley. It's great for you. And there's also other nutrients in barley, which makes it particularly good. It improves you from having a heart attack and stroke. That's great. It helps lower oxidized cholesterol. That's great. It lowers total cholesterol. That's terrific. Right? It gets down the low density lipoproteins, the LDL, which are very bad. And because barley is a rich source of soluble and insoluble fiber, both of which benefit your gastrointestinal health, it helps you have normal bowel movements. So if you know someone who's constipated or irregular, having barley each day can help make them regular. And that makes a person a lot healthier. Because remember, when you have a backup from eating the typical American diet, let's say you're having hot dogs, bad bacteria, any form of animal protein, bad bacteria, then you cook it at a high temperature. Not only is it bad bacteria, now you're introducing inflammation into the gut. Now let's say you have coffee following that, or you have a soft drink during that, like a hot dog, hamburger, and a soda. You've created a terrible, highly acidic, highly inflammatory milieu in the intestine and stomach. All that can contribute to colorectal cancer, but it also contributes to constipation. The longer food is in the intestine, fermenting or rotting, the more dangerous it becomes. So a barley can sweep it out, and that's what you want. And it also helps. It helps the body to be able to rehydrate easier. Then black beans also. Black beans are one of your healthiest of all beans, and yet it's one of the least eaten beans. Why, I don't know. But there's lots of good science showing it reduces glycemic response. And even a high glycemic response, it brings down, meaning brings that blood sugar down. And so those are the two that I would definitely use. And it also, it's been shown that a high bean diet, just any bean diet, lowers the risk of cancer, lowers the risk of cardiovascular disease, lowers the risk of obesity, lowers the risk of gastrointestinal disturbances. So do the right thing and get the beans into the diet. Now to the other nutrients, and that includes carnitine. Carnitine restores cellular function, and over time, our mitochondria, that's the energy factory inside our cells, decrease in both number and function. The result is essentially a short-circuiting of power to every area of your body. So keeping these cellular powerhouses functioning properly can postpone many of the so-called inevitable signs of aging. Research now shows that the amino acid carnitine can forestall, even reverse, many well-known factors of aging. And with advancing age, carnitine levels decline in all of our tissues. That spells trouble for mitochondria, which become starved of energy and filled with cellular waste. Simply put, a carnitine deficiency leads to wholesale destruction of our mitochondria. And ultimately, this loss of mitochondrial function leads to your death. So you want to make sure that you're getting your carnitine. Now, why is the mitochondria important? I'll spend a little extra time on this because I think it's important. The mitochondria reside in every cell in our bodies. They power cells by converting food into energy our body needs to operate. Think of the mitochondria like the power company that supplies energy to your home. If the power goes out, your food spoils, your heating and air conditioning won't work, and you have no light. The same effect occurs within our body. If the mitochondria, your power supply, is not functioning properly, or if it decreases in numbers, then your cells won't have the energy it needs to power your body's many functions. Now, as the amount of functioning mitochondria decrease, many of the symptoms of aging manifest. Fatigue, where people just don't have that energy, don't have that get up and go anymore. And then exercise, where you put a lot of stress upon the mitochondria. Well, you got to replenish it, and people don't realize you got to replenish what you use. And so that's where you get your decline in mitochondrial activity. And so I would suggest using 500 to 1,000 milligrams minimal of carnitine. Study after study shows, even in placebo control, that up to 4 grams a day makes an enormous difference. And people with angina, an early sign of heart muscle disease, and generally from a low blood flow, benefited from carnitine supplements in a big way. It also increases nitric oxide to help endothelial cells relax and releases more blood flow, and that can help lower blood pressure. Also can help a lot of men with erectile dysfunction. And so let's just say 1 gram, 1,000 milligrams a day to start. I think that diabetics would benefit, because most diabetics suffer from ischemic or low blood flow and non-ischemic heart muscle dysfunction, and much of which can be reduced by long-term carnitine supplementation. It also fights obesity, and you need that. So let's get the carnitine into our cells in a big way. And athletes, you really need carnitine. Now, the basic L-carnitine molecule that supports mitochondrial function is available in several forms. There's L-carnitine tartrate, there's acetyl L-carnitine, which is a molecule chiefly active in moving fat molecules across the mitochondrial membrane, and it readily crosses the brain-blood barrier, and arginocarn, and glycine, which... there's a lot that works, so use whatever one you want. Just ask for L-carnitine. So you're going to feel better, you're going to do better. I'm very concerned that we have become so focused upon our security that we have had our basic constitutional rights taken from us by both those in the corporate left and right, by policymakers who have not fought back against this. There have been groups like the American Civil Liberties Union, and there have certainly been individuals. But by and large, the American public has not protested. There have been no general strikes, there's been no unions, there's been no major activist movement to say, stop this. So every time we turn around, there's another explanation as to why we have to be invading a country, why the people in a given area are now considered enemy combatants, because we just don't want to have to be identifying people we kill who are not actual enemy combatants because someone will be held accountable. There's virtually no accountability on part of the military. So that brings us to the idea that shouldn't we go back and take a look at what we did in Vietnam and try to learn some lessons? Because the same things that we did in Vietnam we're doing now today in Iraq and Afghanistan. How do I know? Because I have helped a lot of vets, mainly with post-traumatic stress disorder and Gulf War syndrome. I have listened to their stories. I've heard so many vets say that they're ashamed of what they either saw and did nothing about or participated in. And they couldn't live with themselves. And they began to take medications or drugs or alcohol. And they didn't know, how do you get over the fact that you may have killed an innocent kid or someone or been a part of, you know, the rape of a person? You got away with it because the military's not going to do anything about it. But you have to live with that. And no one is touching this in the United States. I think it's time that we took an honest look. I'm going to recommend everyone read Nick's Nick Turse's Kill Anything That Moves, the real American war in Vietnam. And according to Chris Hedges, it's not only one of the most important books ever written about the Vietnam conflict, but it provides the readers with an unflinching account of the nature of modern industrial warfare. It captures, as few books or on more do, the utter depravity of industrial violence, what the sociologist James William Gibson calls techno-war. It exposes the sickness of the hyper-masculine military culture. Think of Geraldo. Think of the embedded journalists. Think of Bill Riley. Think of all the colonels and admirals and officers they come through banging drums. Think of Judith Miller, the New York Times. Think of the self-righteousness of all those people who said, yes, we need to be, of Westmoreland, of all the people, we need to be there. If we're not there fighting them, they'll be here in America fighting us. Really? This is a intoxicating rush, and it leads to addiction of violence. And the massive government spin machine that lies daily to a gullible public and uses tactics of intimidation and threats and smear campaigns to silence dissenters. Turse finally grasped that the trauma that plagues most combat veterans is a result not only of what they witnessed or endured, but what they did. This trauma, shame, guilt, and self-revulsion push many combat vets, whether from Vietnam, Iraq, or Afghanistan, to escape into narcotic and alcohol fogs or commit suicide. By the end of Turse's book, you understand why. This is not the book Turse set out to write. He was, when his research began back in June of 2001, a graduate student looking at post-traumatic stress disorder among Vietnam veterans. And an archivist at the U.S. National Archives asked Turse whether he thought witnessing war crimes could cause post-traumatic stress disorder. And he steered Turse to yellowing reports amassed by the Vietnam War Crimes Working Group. Now, the group set up in the wake of My Lai massacre was designed to investigate the hundreds of reports of torture, rape, and kidnapping, and forced displacement, and beatings, and arson, and mutilation, and executions, and massacres carried out by the U.S. troops. But the object of the group was not to discipline. It was not to halt the abuses. It was, as Turse writes, to ensure that the Army would never again be caught off guard by a major war crime scandal. War crimes, for Army investigators, were an image management problem. Those charged with war crimes were rarely punished. The numerous reports of atrocities collected by the Vietnam War Crimes Working Group were kept secret, and the eyewitnesses who reported war crimes were usually ignored or discredited or cowed into silence. Now, Turse used the secret Pentagon reports and documents to track down more than 100 veterans, including those who had reported witnessing atrocities to their supervisors and others charged with carrying out atrocities. And he went to Vietnam to interview survivors. Now, a decade later, he produced a masterpiece. Case after case in his book makes it painfully clear that soldiers and Marines deliberately maimed, abused, beat, tortured, raped, wounded, or killed hundreds of thousands of unarmed civilians, including children, with impunity. Troops engaged in routine acts of sadistic violence, usually associated with demented Nazi concentration camp guards. And what Turse describes is a woefully incomplete portrait, since he found that an astonishing number of Marine court-martial records of the era have apparently been destroyed, as well as the Air Force Naval criminal investigations gone. The few incidents of wanton killing in Vietnam, and this is also true for the wars in Iraq and Afghanistan, that did become public, such as My Lai, were dismissed as an aberration, the result of a few soldiers or Marines gone bad. But, as Turse makes clear, such massacres were and are, in our current imperial adventures, commonplace. The slaughters were the inevitable outcome of deliberate policies dictated at the highest levels of the military. They were carried out because the dominant tactic of the war, as conceived by our politicians and generals, was centered on the concept of overkill. And when troops on the ground could not kill fast enough, then the gunships and the helicopters, the fighter jets and the bombers came to their assistance. The U.S. Air Force contributed to the demented quest of overkill, eradicating so many of the enemy that recuperation was theoretically impossible. By dropping the equivalent of 640 Hiroshima-sized atomic bombs on Vietnam, most actually falling on the south where our purported Vietnamese allies resided. And planes didn't just drop bombs, they unloaded more than 70 million tons of herbicide agents, 3 million white phosphorus rockets. White phosphorus, by the way, will burn its way in through your entire body. 400,000 tons of jellied incendiary napalm. 35% of the victims died within 15 to 20 minutes. Death from the skies, like death on the ground, was often unleashed capriciously. It was not out of the ordinary for U.S. troops in Vietnam to blast a whole village or bombard a wide area in an effort to kill a single sniper. Murder is an integral part of war, and the most disturbing form of murder, because it is so intimate, is carried out by infantry troops. The godlike power that comes with the ability to destroy anything, including other human beings, along with intoxicating firepower of industrial weapons, rapidly turns those who wield these weapons into beasts. Human beings are reduced to objects, toys to satiate a perverse desire to dominate, humiliate, and control and kill. Corpses are trophies. Many of the Vietnamese who were murdered were first subjected to degrading forms of public abuse, gang rapes, torture, and savage beatings. They were, according to Terse, confined in tiny barbed-wired cow cages and sometimes jabbed with sharpened bamboo sticks while inside them. And other detainees were placed in large drums filled with water. The containers were then struck with great force, which caused internal injuries but left no scars. Some were suspended by ropes for hours on end or hung upside down and beaten, a practice called the plane ride. Or they were chained with their hands over their heads, arms fully extended, so their feet could barely touch the ground, a version of an age-old torture called the strapado. Untold numbers were subjected to electric shocks from crank-operated field telephones and battery-powered devices or even cattle prods. Soles of the feet were beaten, fingernails were ripped out, fingers were dismembered. Detainees were slashed with knives, suffocated, burned by cigarettes, beaten with clubs, sticks, bamboo, flails, baseball bats. Many were threatened with death or even subjected to mock executions. And all this, all witnessed by and supported by the CIA, Army Intelligence, and everyone in the command knew. All that suffering was more or less ignored as it happened, and then written out of history even more thoroughly in the decades since. Terse, in one of the many accounts, described a string of atrocities committed in the Duc Po border region in 1967 by Charlie Company, 2nd Battalion, 35th Infantry, under the command of Captain James Lanning. A wounded detainee was dumped into a boat and pushed into a rice paddy where he was riddled with bullets and finished off with a grenade. A wounded woman was covered with straw and then set on fire. Paul Halverson, a soldier and military combat correspondent who accompanied the unit, when asked about the total number of civilians killed by this group, it was in the hundreds. That's just one small group. Major Gordon Livingston, a regimental surgeon with the 11th Armored Cavalry Regiment, in 1971 testified before Congress that he witnessed a helicopter pilot who swooped down on two Vietnamese women riding bicycles and killed them with the helicopter skids. Soldiers and Marines, as is common in all wars, collected body parts of dead Vietnamese, heads, noses, scalps, breasts, teeth, ears, fingers, genitals, and displayed them or wore them in necklaces. There were people in all the platoons with ears on cords, said Jimmy Bushby, member of the 75th Rangers. told an Army criminal investigator. Corpses were dressed up and twisted into comic poses for photographs, or gruesomely mutilated. Severed heads of Vietnamese were mounted on spikes or poles in Army camps. The dead were lashed onto Army vehicles, which at times ran over Vietnamese civilians for sport. Rape was as common as murder. A veteran from the 198th Light Infantry Brigade is quoted by Tersus saying that he knew of 15 rapes of young girls by soldiers from his unit within a short period of time. A Vietnamese woman in an Army report said that she was detained by troops from the 173rd Airborne Brigade and then raped by approximately 10 soldiers. In another incident, 11 members of one squad of the 23rd Infantry Division raped a Vietnamese girl. As word spread, another squad traveled to the scene to join in. In a third incident, an American GI recalled seeing a Vietnamese woman who was hardly able to walk after she'd been gang raped by 13 soldiers. A Marine in the book spoke about a 9-man squad that entered a village to hunt for a Kong whore. The squad found a woman, raped her, and then shot her through the head. One Marine remembered finding a Vietnamese woman who had been shot and wounded. Severely injured, she begged for water. Instead, her clothes were ripped off. She was stabbed in both breasts, then forced into a spread eagle position, after which the handle of an entrenching tool, essentially a short-handled shovel, was thrust up her vagina. Other women were violated with objects ranging from soda bottles to rifles. Vietnamese were detained in the country's massive incarceration camps. They were slapped, punched, kicked, sexually assaulted, given electric shocks, and waterboarded. Military commanders and politicians were seduced by the destructive fury they could call down on the enemy. Walls of automatic rifle fire, hundreds of rounds of belt-fed machine gun fire, 90mm tank rounds, endless sheets of grenades, mortars, artillery shells, and claymore mines saturated the countryside, while gigantic 2,700-pound explosive projectiles were fired from battleships along the coast. Canisters of napalm and daisy cutter bombs, anti-personnel rockets, high-explosive rockets, incendiary rockets, cluster bombs, high-explosive shells, and iron fragmentation bombs, including the 40,000-pound bomb loads dropped by giant B-52 Stratofortress bombers, along with chemical defoliants and chemical gases, were dropped from the sky. This was a ceaseless assault. The generals, the politicians, believed in victory. The gleeful tally of the dead was captured in perverse practice of body counts, macabre scoreboard, to prove that our side was winning. The official license granted to soldiers and Marines to kill anyone came in the form of a free fire zone, a term later changed by the military to a more neutral-sounding specified strike zone. Here's what it means. It's kind of like Orwellian logic of military institutions. In these zones, troops were informed there were no civilians because everyone in a free fire zone was considered the enemy. Women, children, the elderly, those in hospitals, babies, they were all legitimate targets. And you could not be held responsible for firing on innocent civilians since, by definition, there were none. Everyone. If you had 1,000 women in a village and you killed everyone, not a thing would happen because they were all combatants. That's what they were believed. And when patrol shot and killed groups of unarmed civilians outside of officially designated free fire zones, they unilaterally decided to designate their killing sites as free fire zones. War always exalts and elevates psychotic killers. Vietnam became their playground. Sergeant Roy Bumgardner of the Army's 1st Cavalry Division and later the 173rd Airborne Brigade reportedly amassed an astonishing personal body count of more than 1,500 enemy kills, sometimes logging more kills with his 6-man Wildcat team than the rest of his 500-man battalion combined. Reports of Bumgardner's indiscriminate killing sprees, excessive even by the standards of Vietnam, filtered back to the high command. In March 1968, Private Arthur Williams, a sniper on Bumgardner's scout team, informed military authorities that on at least 4 occasions, it seen Baumgartner kill unarmed Vietnamese civilians. Baumgartner often planted Chinese communist grenades on the bodies of his victims, including children, so they could be called in as dead enemy troops. Charlie Boss, who was on the Sergeant's Wildcat team, is quoted as telling an Army criminal investigator, "Only a couple weeks ago, I heard Baumgartner had killed a Vietnamese girl and two younger boys who didn't have any weapons." Baumgartner was eventually court-martialed after numerous eyewitness reports of his propensity for murder. He was convicted of premeditated murder, reduced in rank, and fined. But he never went to jail. He continued his career in the military. He even was given back his old rank. The military was not about to lose his services. When you take a look at someone like Colonel John Donaldson, a West Point graduate and former Olympian, organize gook hunts from helicopters. One officer is quoted in the book as saying that that Donaldson is chief intelligence officer, quote, the quote of gook is from the book, flew around in the colonel's chopper with a crate of grenades, frags they call them, and popped them in the rice fields over the dinks. I guess that's a word that's from the book, meaning Vietnamese. It's a slang, pejorative slang. Who would attempt to run for cover when the copter swooped down to chase them. When enough reports of Colonel's killing made it up the chain of command, his fellow officers, including Colin Powell, who had served with him for 8 months in Vietnam, made sure the charges were ignored or dismissed. Let me quote that again. Colin Powell, who served with him for 8 months, made sure the charges were ignored or dismissed. Two of the key witnesses willing to testify against him, apparently under pressure, changed their testimony. The colonel was never reprimanded. The killing campaign of General Julian Ewell, nicknamed the Butcher of the Delta, reached staggering genocidal proportions in the Mekong Delta, where he commanded the 9th Division. Ronald Bartek, in the book, remembered that the general wanted to begin killing 4,000 of these little bastards, quote, and then by the end of the following month wanted to kill, quote, 6,000, and so on from there. Ewell launched an operation called Speedy Express that explored ways to get as many people killed as possible. The provincial hospitals were soon flooded with civilian wounded. A veteran disturbed by the massive loss of life wrote to General William Westmoreland, the Army's chief of staff. He explained Ewell's tactics, quote, if anybody ever got sniper fire from a tree line, we'd use gunships and artillery on the villages and go in later. He listed the names of the officers pushing the soldiers to carry out the massacres. He pleaded with the military to put a halt to the carnage. He wrote that any civilian who ran from U.S. troops was instantly shot. He detailed in the letter how a battalion would kill 20 a day, with four battalions in the brigade that would be maybe 50 a day to 12 or 1,200 to 1,500 a month, easily. One battalion claimed 1,000 body count in 1 month. If I'm only 10% right, and believe me, it's a lot more, then we're looking at a lot of murders. These soldiers and Marines did report the war crimes they witnessed could sometimes face a fate worse than being pressured, discredited, or ignored. On September 12, 1969, Terse writes, George Chunko sent a letter to his parents explaining how his unit had entered a home that had a young Vietnamese woman, four young children, an elderly man, and a military-aged male. It appeared the younger man was AWOL from the South Vietnamese Army, our ally. The young man was stripped naked and tied to a tree. His wife fell to her knees and begged the soldiers for mercy. The prisoner was ridiculed, slapped around, and had mud in his face, and then he was executed. The day after he wrote the letter, he was killed, and he was killed, his parents said, because they murdered him to cover up the crime. In conclusion, the almost unfathomable scale, the slaughter, the contribution of our technical, industrial, and scientific apparatus to create deadlier weapon systems implicates huge sections of our society in war crimes. the military and weapons manufacturers openly speak of the war as a laboratory for new forms of killing. Tursa's book obliterates the image we have of ourselves as a good and virtuous nation. It mocks the popular belief that we have a right to impose our virtues on others by force. It exposes the soul of our military, which has achieved through relentless propaganda and effective censorship a level of public adulation that is terrifying. Tursa reminds us who we are, and in an age of expanding wars in the Middle East, routine torture, murderous air and drone strikes, targeted assassination, yes, we have worked consciously and unconsciously to erase the terrible truth about Vietnam and ultimately about ourselves. This is a tragedy, for if we were able to remember who we were, if we knew what we were capable of doing to others, then we might be less prone to replicating the industrial slaughter of Vietnam in Iraq, Afghanistan, Pakistan, Somalia, and Yemen. After the war, Tursa concludes, most scholars wrote off the accounts of widespread war crimes that recur throughout Vietnamese revolutionary publications and American anti-war literature as merely so much propaganda. Few academic historians even thought to cite such sources, and almost none did so extensively. Meanwhile, May Lai came to stand for and thus blot out all other American atrocities. Vietnam War bookshelves are now filled with big-picture histories, sober studies of diplomacy and military tactics, and combat memories told from the soldier's perspective. Buried in forgotten U.S. government archives, locked away in the memories of atrocity survivors, the real American War in Vietnam has all but vanished from public consequences. So please keep this in mind. We have become a warmongering nation. More often than not because of ideology, but simply because of sustainable, unlimited growth. Thousands of subcontractors now participate at enormous profits to being part of the outsourcing of war. And they're the ones who continue to have lobbyists on Capitol Hill. They're the ones who continue to convince journalists to write stories about how we are threatened if we do not take preemptive action, that we need even more military bases and we need to spend even more on our innovative drone programs. We have militarized the American police forces. We have taken away people's rights to demonstrate against war, against corruption, against excessive use of force. To do so anywhere in America today, you will absolutely, positively, unequivocally, in every instance, you will be cataloged. You will be determined to be an enemy of the state. And then one of these private groups will be able to source all the data about you, to go back through your phone records, to look at anything that you have on your computer, to assess you, and then to profile you. So that if you ever end up leading a group, if you ever become popular, they'll have enough information on you that they can cause you to vanish. So it is today. And yet, we continue to pride ourselves on our ability to inflict pain upon a world. And we never ask at what cost. It's substantial. I'm Gary Nall. Now time for TalkBack, 888-874-4888, 888-874-4888. We'll take a few calls on any of the topics you'd like to discuss. Your turn. Let's say hello to Ronald from New York City. Hi, Ronald. Your turn.
Hello. How are you today?
Good.
I wanted to ask you about the fluoridated water. What are some of the symptoms of drinking fluoridated water?
It's not that you will have symptoms per se, because it's a toxin that can interfere in mineral metabolism. It depletes our immune system, and it's a carcinogen. My suggestion is read the article that I wrote and is always updated on the fluoride fiasco. It gives all the scientific evidence against fluoride that no one should be putting fluoride from water, from toothpaste, from mouthwash into our bodies at all. Okay? And let's say John from Long Island. Hi, John, your turn.
Hi, Gary. Gary?
Yeah, I can hear you, John. What's up?
Yeah, I'm sorry. Hi, this is John again. Gary, I know you're going to be working on your documentary. You're working on it, on the tipping point, which is a result of our poor choices on the physical side.
Yes.
But I'd like to offer the audience some hope here on the spiritual and the thoughtful side with spontaneous healing through good thoughts, productive thoughts, love and harmony. I think that can work, which brings me to the 100 monkey theory in the 1940s, where there was a shift through thought that changed the monkeys, the way they operated.
John, unfortunately, we're out of time, but the 100 monkey theory was completely discredited. It didn't happen. For those in the New Age movement, it was always a wonderful discussion, but the reality wasn't. What we have to realize is that with our love and our spirituality and our peace of mind, that will do absolutely nothing to change those who are in power who exercise none of the above. And we can run off to spiritual centers in the United States. That won't change the power structure. It is only when we stop voting for them and when we stand united and boycott them, when we take our money out of their banks, stop shopping in their box stores and their mall stores, stop using their credit cards, stop listening to their radio programs, their television programs. You have to boycott them at every level you can and tell friends to do the same, and for good reason. That's why I brought up that article earlier today in the program about Gardasil. More and more parents are looking at the literature. They're reading the unofficial literature, but the true literature on the internet, and saying, why should I put my child's life in harm's way just to make more profit for a pharmaceutical company? Historically, that would never have been the case. There would have been no questioning. Now we are questioning everything because we realize that all of these politicians are self-serving sociopaths. And I know of no one in power who's not a sociopath. So do not ever trust the sociopaths. Nice to have a call from you. I'm Gary Nall. We're out of time. I want to thank you all for listening. Now we're going to continue on for another minute here. We'll go to Luann Panessi. Hi, Luann.
Gary, I have an email here. Talk about the psychopaths that are running the joint. I got an email about this, what's happening in Cyprus, which is this island country just east of Greece and south of Turkey. Obviously, part of the meltdown in Europe. The Cyprus... Europe's debt crisis czar decided that the way they're going to correct problems in Cyprus is they agreed on a tax, these czars, so that if anyone deposits money, say $150,000 or less, suddenly they're going to impose a levy of 6.75%. And anything above $150,000, they'll get nearly a 10% levy. And people are asking, could this possibly happen here?
Okay, just a slight correction. What happened was this. They didn't ask this Cypriotic people if they wanted this. They mandated it by automatically deducting that out of their accounts. So if you had $10, you had $10 million, you had money taken out up to 10%, 9.9%. If you had more than $100,000, but it was 5.8 if it was less. That gave them immediately about $5.8 billion. They were looking for a little over $10 billion. Now, what they should have done, they simply should have said, instead of taking money out of people's bank accounts without people having any choice in the matter, why don't we simply say no to the loans from the International Monetary Fund, because it was not the people of Cyprus that caused the problem. It was the banks and the speculation. So they should have brought the full burden on the banks and nationalized the banks, and then downsized the banks, forgave their debt, and then they wouldn't have had this problem at all. But they went right along with the same programs being used in Greece, in Spain, in another Latvia, another country, Slovakia, that are part of the European Union. So needless to say, the people in Cyprus are outraged today to wake up and find out that a large chunk of their money is gone from their bank accounts, and it's not coming back. And that's not going to solve the problem. The next thing will be the more austerity programs. It's a completely failed concept. By the way, more people are now seeking food assistance in Europe from the European Union countries than at any time since the end of the Second World War. So when you have that much unemployment, and the real unemployment rate in the United States is closer to 23%, what they do, they keep, and what's amazing is the official left and the corporate left will say how good, even on non-commercial radio stations, I'll hear people say, oh, and the unemployment rate is now, 7.8%. Wrong. They simply take everyone who gave up looking for work and deduct them. They're no longer counted. If you counted everyone who was able to work, who once did work and is no longer looking for a job, the unemployment rate is 23%. Gives you a different face on things. Thanks for your call. Let's say hello to Utrice Lead. Hi, Utrice.
Hello, Gary. Today we are spending the entire hour talking about America's deadliest export. It's democracy.
Great. We look forward to it. Utrice Lead coming at you in just a moment. Please stay with us.
I want everybody to get up off your seat and get your arms together and your hands together and give me some of that.